This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Be there.
صفرا ورضومه
ورقة ودم لقلبي الكثري بنساب طيب الجنان فاح نسامه بالند والمسك المخدوم فرجة ضربت ماليها سومة مع غزالي ما تشبهها بنت سموحة الان في حارس زركام ولا في بلاد الروم ايدي نموت بيا بالطومة ليلة الحرية بالصيلة على الريام زين العشيق رسام وفرشة انسان بالطوم والسلفي الكام انقاب جبين للاح غيام وضواض يا بين الجوم حاجبين سود وشفار سومة والعيون سرادة زادوا لساكني تعدى الخد خال ورد غلام وقعت من بها مرغوم ايدي نموت بيا فرطومة حرية السيلة على الرياب زين العشيق انسان وفرش انسان بالملاك المعصومة وجه آدم ونوح وعيسى بن مريم بجه من إلك ظلام وجد الشرف سيد القوم إذا نموت بيا في الطومة ليلة الحرية الصيلة على الرياض زين العشيق رصام وفرشت رصام الطوم إذا نموت بيا في الطومة ليلة الحرية الصيلة على الريام زين العشيق رصام وفرشت رصام الطوم لهمومك في دلع العشية لهمومك في دلع العشية تدري بشياتيك الصباح بشياتيك الصباح في سحر قوم دير الحومية في سحر قوم دير الحومية تبني حياتك معنيها حياتك
Opening up here on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City with sounds of Abdel Hadi Hallo and the El Gusto Orchestra of Algiers. Recorded recently in 2006, but in a very consciously retro style, which was sort of a throwback to the 1920s and the whole North African musical renaissance, which took place in that era. You might remember a few shows back, we dipped into a compilation of music from that era, from the Secret Museum of Mankind, compiled by Pat Conte. Well, this is a contemporary group from Algeria, which sort of plays in that old school style, and one of the things which makes the old school style unique and charming is the fact that it's very much a tutti frutti. It's very eclectic. It's taken a little bit of this and a little bit of that. You've got Arabic, Berber, Jewish, Moorish, and Iberian stuff, kind of all mixed together in the sound and in the songs and the choice of repertoire. And in fact, that's even evident from the name. Obviously, they've got a Spanish name, the El Gusto Orchestra of Algiers. Now, to my mind, the El Gusto Orchestra is redundant, because you know, the article is there twice. The and El mean the same thing. But I suppose I should take that up with Abdel Hadi Hallo. Well, anyway, I certainly love their music, and we'll be hearing more of it. You know, I'd like to, with my tongue in my cheek, dedicate this music that we're playing tonight to, the Barbary Pirates of the early, 19th century and, their maritime jihad against Christendom. Because, well, you know, the pirates are back in the news, as doubtless listeners are aware. And this, well, I'm going to sort of use the piracy crisis off of Somalia as a peg to hang the discussion tonight. Now, longtime listeners of this radio show will be aware that our spiritual advisor, Hakim Bey, has certainly written about the Barbary Pirates in somewhat romanticized terms, we shall say. In fact, as a matter of fact, I think that the book Pirate Utopias, Moorish Corsairs and European Renegados, Watana Media, 1995, was actually written by the founder emeritus of this radio show, Peter Lamborn Wilson. Who, once again, longtime listeners will recall hearing his voice over these airwaves, low back 10 years ago or more. And, you know, I mean, Peter will acknowledge, in fact, that he takes a very romanticized view of the pirates. You know, he's consciously playing to a sort of poetic nostalgia. And a sort of an imaginal version as that's actually his word. That's one of Peter's special words, which I think he got from Fourier, if I'm not mistaken. An imaginal highly idealized, romanticized sort of image, as the word implies, of the pirates as a contemporary inspiration for those of us who reject commodified culture and the contemporary empire. So I'd like to take, I hope, a somewhat more hard-nosed view of the pirate phenomenon tonight in our discussion, and sort of use it once again as a springboard for a more general discussion. Now, the phone calls that we took last week were hot and heavy. So I hope that those of you who, when time ran out, hadn't been able to get through, I hope that you saved your thought, and we'll take phone calls tonight. Maybe in about a half an hour or 45 minutes, we'll keep going with phone calls, just because we had such a an overwhelming response from the phone calls last week. But let's see how much ranting I can get done between now and then. There's a lot of points I want to touch on. I'm going to endeavor to be brief, but inevitably I rant on longer than I anticipated. So, well, for those of you out there who are paying attention and are history buffs, you'll be aware of the very interesting historical irony or coincidence, or maybe it wasn't a coincidence, that the U.S. Navy destroyer, which was mobilized to Somalia to rescue the captain who was held hostage by the pirates and succeeded over the weekend in rescuing him, the name of that destroyer, I should say that the Navy SEAL operatives on board the destroyer succeeded in rescuing him. The name of that destroyer was the USS Bainbridge. It was named after William Bainbridge, who was one of the naval commanders in the Barbary Wars, which took place between 1800 and 1805. On the North African coast. The famous line in the Marine Corps hymn, "From the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli," is a reference to the Barbary Wars. Largely, the U.S. was at war with Tripoli, which is contemporary Libya, of course. But also, there were brief wars and skirmishes with Algeria and Morocco as well. Tripoli and Algiers were at that time tributaries to the Ottoman Empire, although they were effectively autonomous. Morocco was an independent sultanate, and they were pirate states. All of them were pirate states, and they demanded tribute from any ships which were operating in the Mediterranean, and if they did not receive tribute, they would grab these ships and hold the crew hostage and seize the goods, and ultimately there were hundreds of U.S. Sailors, which were, you know, merchant sailors, who were held by the Barbary pirates until finally Jefferson, President Jefferson, who had been elected as a peacenik and an anti-militarist, and opposed to Adams and the Federalist Party, which were the forerunners of the Republicans, who wanted to beef up the military and jump into all of these foreign military adventures, particularly with France. Jefferson was sort of elected as a representing the Democratic Republicans, who were the forerunners of today's Democrats, was sort of elected as a peacenik and an isolationist, who would keep the U.S. out of wars, and particularly as a Francophile, who wouldn't get us into any wars with revolutionary France, with whom he sympathized. So, to everybody's surprise, as soon as he was elected, he says, okay, well, you know, we've got all of these sailors who are being held in, you know, on the North African coast, and we're not going to take this anymore. And he pushed through a bill which established a navy for the first time. And this was the roots of the U.S. Navy. And he sent a squadron over there to police the Barbary coast. William Bainbridge, one of his commanders, was actually twice, not once, but twice, he had his ship taken by the pirates. He lost his ship to the pirates twice. A real humiliation, although he later vindicated himself in battle and took vengeance upon the pirates, which is why today there is a U.S. naval destroyer which is named after him. And one wonders whether it was a mere coincidence that that's the ship which they sent to the coast of Somalia to fight the contemporary pirates, or if some history buff in the Navy was responsible for this, and they were sending a not so subtle message to the Somali pirates. One wonders. So finally, what happened, interestingly enough, is that the U.S. was sort of taking this hard-nosed position that, you know, there can't be any compromise with pirates or terrorists and people who take hostages, and that we need total defeat of the Barbary States. This was certainly the Federalist position, and it was Jefferson's public position, even though he was with the other party. But there were all of these intrigues going on, and ultimately there was a covert action which was approved by a guy by the name of William Eaton, another naval officer, who was arguably the first U.S. Covert operative. And by that, I don't just mean spies, because certainly there have been plenty of spy craft on both sides in the War of Independence, but somebody who actually led covert actions, as we understand them today, actually, you know, assemble private armies and wage secret wars. That's what he did when we were, I shouldn't use that pronoun we, especially when we're talking about almost 200 years ago, but when the United States was waging war against the pirate state of Tripoli, there were two brothers who were vying for the throne of Tripoli. It was ruled by a bey, not by a sultan, because they were all tributaries to the Ottoman sultan in Constantinople. But it was ruled by a bey, which is sort of like a lord. It's an honorific title. So, and there were two rival brothers who were vying for the throne of Tripoli, and one had got the upper hand and exiled the other to Egypt, which was then controlled by the Ottomans. But there was a very complicated war which was going on. Napoleon was intervening, and then the British were intervening against Napoleon, and so there was kind of a three-way war which was going on between the British, the French, and the Ottomans, and the local regime, the Mamluks, who were like the local tributaries to the Ottomans in Egypt. So this pretender to the throne of Tripoli had been exiled to Egypt. So William Eaton lands a force of his own covert operatives at Alexandria, and goes up the Nile and secures the approval of the local Ottoman Pasha there to launch an expeditionary force and to kick out the Bey who was on the throne of Tripoli and put his brother back in power. And the idea was that his brother, once back in power, would be conciliatory and free the hostages and give the U.S. free trade rights. And really, it was all about free trade rights. And Jefferson was very, very explicit on this. But he said that, you know, behind the issue of the hostages, this is a paraphrase, but it's very close to verbatim. Behind the issue of the hostages is the question of American free trade rights in the Mediterranean. So, and, you know, we were essentially, once again, not we, but the United States was selling rum to the European powers in exchange for manufactured goods by this point, and they needed access to European ports on the Mediterranean without having to pay tribute or ransom, whichever word you want to use, to the pirates. So this was essentially the first U.S. regime change strategy and the first U.S. Secret war or covert operation, where William Eaton assembled a mercenary force of of Mamluks and Bedouins and other French and Greek and Turkish rabble who recruited from the war, which was then going on in Egypt, and marches across the desert and invades Libya, invades the pirate state of Tripoli. So this was kind of like, you know, the neocon strategy, so to speak, right? This was like regime change. We're going to put our guy in power, to put it in, you know, contemporary terms, right? Then he's actually succeeded in taking, let's see, what city was it? I'm going to check my notes here. The easternmost city in what's now Libya, the pirate state of Tripoli at that time. Let's see, that would have been Derna, the city of Derna, which is still today, I believe, the second city in Libya after Tripoli. So he succeeded in taking Derna with his mercenary force, and was ready to march on Tripoli and depose the Bey and put his own guy in power. Then the paleocons, so to speak, launched their counteroffensive, and they were like, no, we can't upset the apple barrel with the apple cart with these adventurous regime change strategies, because that's just going to create too much chaos. So we're going to like cut a deal with the regime which is already in power. So the Bey of Tripoli, who was already in a tight spot because, you know, this foreign army was about to like march on his capital and overthrow him. So he says, okay, we'll cut a deal. And he dramatically dropped his ransom or tribute demand to a much, much, much smaller sum. And the U.S. negotiator said, okay, deal. You got it. So the war was over. And the pretender to the throne of Tripoli was completely sold out down the river and was sent into exile. And the forces who had fought for him were scattered and pretty brutally put down. So it was kind of like what happened to the Kurds in the immediate aftermath of Operation Desert Storm, for those of you who can remember back then, back when another paleocon was in power. Actually, you know, George Bush, the first, George Herbert Walker Bush, he kind of played both sides between the paleocons and the neocons, whereas his son, George W. Bush, was quite clearly in the pocket of the neocons. So that's what happened way back in 1803, if memory serves. And then there were continued to be smaller skirmishes with the Algerian pirates after that. The wars kept going on. Actually, there was even a little reprise of this in the War of 1812, when the Algerian pirates, this time at the behest of the British, started once again harassing U.S. trade in the Mediterranean. And then the French intervened. When did the French intervene? A few years after that, I believe. 18, I think we're probably getting into the 1830s by the time the French finally intervened and conquered North Africa, of course, as we all know, and put an end to the Barbary pirates. So it has to be said that one of the reasons I facetiously, and no slur is intended, to our good friend Abdel Hadi Hallo and the Augusta Orchestra of Algiers, when I facetiously dedicated the music to the Barbary Pirates, well, what I was thinking of, in fact, is that one aspect of the history, which Peter Lamborn Wilson brings to light in his book Pirate Utopias, which is not emphasized by, as you can imagine, since 9/11 and the intervention in Iraq and Afghanistan, there's been this whole slew of titles, a few of which I've read, about the Barbary Wars, because that was like America's first war on Islamic terrorism. So all of these contemporary histories do not emphasize what Peter Lamborn Wilson emphasizes in Pirate Utopias, is that the to a certain extent the Barbary states, the pirate states of North African coast, were sort of, you know, these multi-culti autonomous zones, which were actually quite tolerant by the standards of their day, and particularly by European standards. Ultimately, all of this goes back to the expulsion of the Moors from Spain in 1492, when the Muslims of Spain were forced with either converting by the sword or being kicked out or being put to the torch. And those who fled, you know, lost their property and their land and so on. So they started launching raids on Spain to get back their property, which had been expropriated from them by the Catholic Reconquista of Spain. And then military expeditions were launched against North Africa, where, you know, the refugees had taken refuge and established themselves, and from whence they were launching their raids back on Spain to try to, you know, get back their abandoned property. The Spanish crown and the Habsburg Empire, of which Spain was then a part, started launching military raids into North Africa to put down what were seen as pirate raids. That was not how the Moors saw them, of course. The Moors saw them as, you know, exacting a little bit of justice after we've been, you know, cleansed from our homeland in Iberia. But the Habsburgs saw it as pirate raids and started launching military expeditions. One of the big battles, incidentally, one of the leaders was none other than Hernando Cortes, the conqueror of Mexico. After his conquest of Mexico, after he had returned to Spain, he was mobilized against the pirates of the Barbary Coast, and actually was involved in an attempted invasion of Algeria, which was repulsed by none other than Barbarossa, Redbeard the Pirate. So one of my favorite historical episodes, Redbeard versus Cortez. How can you resist it? And it sort of escalated from there, and it turned into this centuries-long showdown between the powers of Christendom and the Barbary Corsairs. That's actually the more proper word. They weren't actually pirates, they were corsairs, because they were ostensibly acting not just as freebooters, but as tributaries to the Turkish Empire, tributaries to the Sublime Porte at Constantinople, as it was known, the Ottoman throne. So it continued. You know, their real heyday was late 18th, early 19th century. And they were sort of, you know, the U.S. kind of cut a deal with them after the Barbary Wars, as just discussed. And this was a real bone of contention, because the elements of the day, which are analogous to the contemporary neocons, assailed this, who were mostly in the Federalist Party, the forerunner of today's Republicans, assailed this as a capitulation to terrorists. The fact that, you know, they cut a deal and they actually did pay something, albeit much, much less than when it had originally been asked, to the Corsair states for the right not to have, you know, U.S. shipping harassed on the Mediterranean. And it was defended as an honorable policy by Jefferson and by the Democratic Republican Party, forerunners of today's Democrats, and by the forces which were analogous to what we today call the paleocons, who ironically have sort of, I would argue, now sort of gained the upper hand again in alliance with the left wing of the Democratic Party in a strange alliance of convenience, which, you know, is a backlash against the hegemony of the neocons, which we witnessed for the last 8 years under George Bush. And I would say that, you know, the real paleocon operative in the Obama administration is Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, who, of course, is a holdover from the Bush administration and was put in the first counterblow on the part of the paleocons against the neocons when Donald Rumsfeld was forced out after the Iraq adventure started to go south very, very dramatically back in, what was it, 2007, if memory serves. So, all right, so there was sort of a deal which was cut with the Barbary Pirates in after the Barbary Wars. Then there was sort of a brief reprise during the War of 1812, as I noted, where the U.S. briefly went to war with Algeria. But there again, I think, you know, the Algerians sort of backed down after a show of force. And then finally, they were done in by European colonialism, by the French conquering almost all of North Africa. And that, you know, in the 1830s, bringing about the end of the Corsair states. So, now we fast forward, almost 200 years. In fact, you know what? What am I saying? Almost. It's been more than 200 years. I really lose track of time, don't I? I really do lose track of time. Yeah. Back, it's been more than 200 years now since the Barbary Wars, right? 18, 19, 2009. Yeah, it's been more than 200 years since the Barbary Wars. Okay, so fast forwarding 200 years, we've got, once again, the U.S. is at war with pirates in the Islamic world. This time it's the Horn of Africa rather than the Barbary Coast. And the U.S. destroyer, which was just sent in and just waged a successful operation to free a U.S. civilian captain who was being held, was named after William Bainbridge, one of the commanders in the Barbary Wars of 200 years ago. And meanwhile, some 200 sailors are still being held by the contemporary Somali pirates, not Americans, but international from countries all over the world. I don't believe any Americans are currently being held. Although it was on the order of 200 Americans who were being held at various times by Algeria and Tripoli in the Barbary crisis of 200 years ago. So there certainly is every potential for this to escalate. This is a chokehold, a choke point, for the world's oil, the bottom of the Red Sea. It's like, you know, you've got the Suez Canal at the top, and then you've got the Gulf of Aden, separated from the Red Sea by this very narrow strait, at the bottom. So this is a chokehold for the world's oil. And the reason that, you know, the situation has been tolerated for so long is because, you know, it's just perceived that this is just a bunch of pirates. And these, unlike the Algerian or the Barbary Corsairs of 200 years ago, these really are well and truly pirates by any definition. They are not, or they don't appear to be answerable to any government. They appear to be freebooters. So, I think that the threat which they represented has been sort of downplayed on account of that. You know, it's not like there's any world power which is manipulating them. They really are just freebooters. But now, you know, now they're holding 200 hostage, and they seized a huge shipment of weapons, including, you know, hundreds of tanks, which were bound from Ukraine to, it's uncertain where exactly. The port of call was Mombasa, Kenya, but it's uncertain if the tanks were actually intended for the Kenyan military or for, there's some speculation that they might have been headed for Sudan, whether the Sudanese government or the southern Sudanese forces, which have established, you know, their own, now legally established their own autonomous zone in the south under the peace accords, which could well break down. But I digress. They're now, the powers that be in this world are now starting to appreciate, well, you know, these guys may just be a bunch of freebooters, but, you know, this kind of fits with the contemporary pattern of so-called asymmetrical warfare. And they really do represent a threat. And now, you know, the United States has sent quite a substantial naval force. Most of the major European powers have also sent a substantial naval force. As has Japan and even North Korea, if you can believe it or not, has actually got some kind of naval expedition in the region to police it. So very interesting to see where this is going to go. You know, one real interesting thing is that, once again, the question which I'm going to ultimately pose is what do, you know, we as anti-imperialists and so on, how do we view the whole thing? Because, you know, back when there was a Cold War, and back when, you know, conflict in this world was generally between states, it was a lot easier to take a clear-cut position. In this age of asymmetrical warfare, it isn't so easy, you know? And it's not so easy for the people who are in power, and it's not so easy for us who oppose the people in power. So one particular irony is that, let's see, when was it? I believe it was about 2 years ago, this sort of Taliban-type entity called the Islamic Courts Union took power in Somalia and established a sort of a Taliban regime, a sort of Sharia regime, probably with some degree of funding from Saudi Arabia. And they cut down, you know, on the warlordism and the piracy and so on. Although not as completely as some would have you believe, because one thing which you have to keep in mind is that the Islamic Courts Union and now the, jumping ahead of myself a little bit, the transitional federal government of Somalia, which has succeeded it, they really only control the southern third of Somalia, and the northern two-thirds of the country are self-governing autonomous zones, respectively known as Puntland and Somaliland. Basically, Somalia, or government-controlled Somalia, is the former Italian colony in the south. Right? I think so, yeah. Whereas the two independent, de facto independent, their independence is not recognized by any nations on Earth or by the UN, but de facto independent autonomous zones, which govern their own business in the north of the country, are the former British colony, right? So, and they have been under relative peace while so-called government-controlled Somalia has been, it's been total hell and has just been contested by warlords ever since 1991 when the Saeed Barre dictatorship fell. The two autonomous enclaves in the north, Puntland and Somaliland, which are not recognized by any government on Earth, ironically, they've been at peace. So, any event. So, but the fact that they've at peace also means that the pirates have been able to operate, particularly out of Puntland, it seems, unmolested. Now, recently, Puntland, the military forces of Puntland, under international pressure, have started to crack down on the pirate bases to a certain extent. But they seem to be outgunned by the pirates, and it's not surprising, given that the pirates have got, you know, millions of dollars in ransom payments at this point. Now, I don't know exactly where this money is going. I guess it's going into Swiss bank accounts. They must have some friends in high places, which are, you know, managing their money for them. I'm not privy to how it works. But in any event, all right, to get back to the story. So what, about 2 years ago, this sort of Taliban operation called the Islamic Courts Union seizes power in so-called government-controlled Somalia, which in fact has never been controlled by the government. It's a complete contradiction in terms and has been the part of Somalia which is the most violent and the most chaotic. Seizes control in that part of Somalia, in the south, which people in the media, in its shorthand, calls Somalia, even though it's only one-third of the country. They're in power for a few months. What would this have been? Let's see. I think this was the end of 2006. And then the beginning of 2007, I think. Don't quote me on the dates. I should have checked. Ethiopian military intervenes with the assistance of the United States, certainly with intelligence assistance and certainly with some quiet air support from the United States and probably with actual U.S. military advisors on the ground, invades that southern third of Somalia, which the media refer to as Somalia as if it were the whole country, which it isn't. And kicks out the Islamic Court Union and establishes themselves in power, under under Ethiopian military occupation, U.S.-backed. This was one of the last really ambitious regime change covert operations of the Bush administration. They kicked out the Islamic Courts Union and put in place the so-called transitional federal government, which is recognized by the outside world, even though it has no power on the ground in Somalia. So, and what power it had was backed up by Ethiopian occupation troops who have only just left, after what, about 2 years. They've just left. Within the last several weeks, they've just left. So now the Islamic Courts Union, while they were in power, had established a modicum of peace. They had cracked down on the pirates. They had cracked down on the warlords, and they had imposed a certain degree of stability. And of course, as soon as they were overthrown, all hell broke loose once again. And now, you know, you've got this chaotic, ultra chaotic war going on once again between, warlords who have come out of the woodwork once again and the transitional federal government, which has been backed up by Ethiopian troops by a profusion of jihadist or Islamist militias which have taken up arms in an insurgency against the Ethiopian occupation and the transitional federal government, some of which are loyal to the Islamic Courts Union, which whose leadership has taken exile in Eritrea, and some of which aren't, and consider the Islamic Courts Union to be too soft, believe it or not. So a lot of people, on the left have sort of argued for, it would have been better to leave well enough alone and just let the Islamic Courts Union stay in power. And that's not what I'm arguing. I'm certainly not arguing in defense of the Ethiopian intervention. I'm not arguing in defense of the Islamic Courts Union either. And I'm taking, once again, this very precarious and unpopular neither nor position. Which is going to bring us to the to the meat of the discussion shortly, I hope. Because predictably, I ranted on for far longer than I had initially intended to. So, once again, the Islamic Courts Union, while they were in power, and the sort of, you know, the local Sharia elements and the Islamist insurgents in the areas which they still control in Somalia, you know, have been committing all of the usual outrages of, you know, stoning women to death for, you know, on suspicion of adultery or on suspicion of being raped, as if it's a woman's fault that she's raped. Let's stone her to death. She was raped. Brilliant. Or, you know, for music. I mean, there were instances in which, you know, local villages out in remote parts of the country were holding their own traditional ceremonies and, you know, getting together and beating on drums around the campfire and dancing and singing traditional songs and so on. And, music. This is a an abomination before Allah. So, you know, the local Shabab militia comes out of the bush and, you know, shoots up the village. You know, all this sort of thing. So, you know, I cannot, by any stretch of the imagination, apologize for this any more than I can apologize for Ethiopian intervention backed up by U.S. Green Berets and the people who oppose it being rounded up and renditioned to the torture chambers of Ethiopia. You know, I can't go along with either of these two things. So who is there to support in Somalia? Well, I don't know who there is to support in Somalia. The closest thing I can see to support in Somalia is the autonomous government of Somaliland, which actually seems to be doing a fairly good job of running the autonomous enclave of Somaliland. And there actually is, you know, if you get on the internet and do some poking around, you'll find that there's actually an independent media there. And the independent media there has actually called out the autonomous administration of Somaliland on authoritarianism and corruption and so on. So there, that's who I support. I support the independent secular media there. That's who I support in all three of the political entities which make up what the media, in their oversimplification, routinely call Somalia. That is to say, government-controlled Somalia, which is itself an oxymoron because it's not controlled by the government, which can barely be said to exist, Puntland and Somaliland. I support the independent media, which is under attack in all three. But it must be said that the independent media in government-controlled Somalia, which isn't really controlled by the government, has been under really brutal attack. And newspaper offices have been blown up and so on. Unclear if it's by the government, by the insurgents. Doesn't matter, okay? Whereas there actually does seem to be something of a free press in Somaliland, even to the point where you know, the independent websites and radio stations and so on there can call out their own local administration on corruption, on authoritarianism and so on. And I'm sure if I looked into it, that there's probably been some human rights abuses in Somaliland too. But at least there's enough elbow room for freedom there. So that there can be an independent media. So even in a situation as grim as Somalia, there are forces which are worth supporting. Now, whether those forces have, you know, got the wherewithal to actually seize power, to me is not the relevant question. Because they are the forces which are going to need our support and our solidarity, regardless of who is in power, right? The people who are actually trying to carve out a little bit of elbow room for freedom and trying to keep out, trying to keep alive dissident voices and secular voices and voices which are going to serve as watchdogs on whichever armed faction is in power, those are the voices which need our support, whichever armed faction is in power. So, that's how I view it. So, this brings us to the question of Iraq and Afghanistan, which brings us to the announcement I was going to make, which is that I am going to be speaking, putting forth this extremely unpopular neither nor position vis-a-vis Iraq at the Left Forum on Sunday morning. It's going to be at Pace University this Sunday morning at 10 o'clock in the morning on a panel entitled Iraq's Civil Resistance, Building Solidarity or something like that. When I play music later on, I will go to the Left Forum website and get the actual specs so I can read them over the air. Somehow, even though I've been brutally, brutally nocturnal lately, I'm going to have to drag my sorry carcass out of bed to be down at the Pace University for the Left Forum on Sunday, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed at the brutal, ungodly, barbaric hour of 10 in the morning to speak coherently about Iraq and the need to support the left civil opposition there, which is under siege, to support the independent media such as Sana TV, which is calling out all sides to the conflict, the U.S. occupation, the collaborationist regime, the Shiite militias, the Sunni militias, the Kurdish nationalist parties, all of them. Provide solidarity to groups such as the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq, who are trying to keep alive elementary freedoms for women, despite an onslaught which is once again coming from all of the armed factions which are vying for control of Iraq, both those in collaboration with the occupation and those who are in insurgency. Solidarity with the trade unions in Iraq, which are attempting to resist the privatization of the oil and so on, and are also getting it from both sides, or I should say all sides, because there's more than two sides to the conflict. Increasingly, now that Obama is escalating the situation in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, we're going to have to bring our attention to this conflict as well and see what the possibilities are for an either-nor position there. In today's New York Times, two stories, which I wish to bring to your attention on page A7. The first is civilians died in airstrike by NATO, Afghan says. An airstrike by NATO forces early Monday in mountainous eastern Afghanistan killed six civilians, including two children. A local Afghanistan official said the latest accusation of civilian casualties leveled against NATO and American forces. NATO officials confirmed the raid, but said only insurgents suspected of planning attacks on the alliance's outpost had been killed. This was contested by Afghan officials, blah, 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 etc., etc., etc. Okay, then immediately after that, there was a very small story, just about one column inch, entitled, Couple Executed for Eloping. Taliban militants publicly executed a man and a woman on Monday for eloping, when the woman was already engaged to marry someone else, a local official said. The two were shot to death in front of a crowd of villagers, said Hashim Norzai, the head of the Kashrud district of Nimruz province, in a sign of the grip that the Islamists have over large parts of Afghanistan. Mr. Norzai said he did not know how the Taliban had come to be involved in passing judgment on the man and woman, but he said much of the province was under the militants' control. So, once again, this is an example of what the secular left forces in the greater Middle East, in the Islamic world, call the two poles of terrorism. U.S. imperialism and political Islam. And they take a neither-nor position, and that's also the position which I am going to argue for. Now, it isn't without its problems and its contradictions and its difficulties, but I find it to be the least contradictory position which is out there, okay? Because there's certain, you know, elements of the left or the post-left, like Christopher Hitchens, who are so appalled by political Islam that they've made their peace with Islamic fundamentalism. With U.S. imperialism, contrary-wise, there's elements of the left like Workers' World Party and their so-called national Bolshevist position, as we discussed last week, which are so appalled by U.S. imperialism that they've made their peace with political Islam or Islamic fundamentalism. And both of these positions strike me as, you know, just complete fundamental betrayal of principle. Now, what makes the neither nor position problematic is that frequently, you know, the for historical reasons which we could discuss, the secular progressive forces are frequently marginal and under siege. Now, in fact, they're under siege just about everywhere. They aren't always so marginal. I believe that they aren't as marginal in Iraq as media accounts would lead us to believe. I believe that, you know, there's certainly quite a strong labor movement in Iraq, without a doubt. In Afghanistan, they really are pretty marginal, and they were pretty much all forced to flee over the past 25 years of war and chaos in Afghanistan, when, fundamentalist factions of various stripes had the upper hand and tore the country apart. And there certainly is a group which I offer complete, forthright, unequivocal solidarity to, which is RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. But it has to be said that they aren't really in Afghanistan. They have very little presence in Afghanistan. They were forced into exile, and they're mostly working in the Afghan refugee camps in Pakistan. And the Pakistani government is now beginning to have these refugees forcibly relocated, which RAWA is protesting. So, I offer RAWA complete solidarity, but I also acknowledge that they haven't got much of a force on the ground in Afghanistan, which makes the situation there a bit more complicated. And also, Pakistan itself now appears to be, you know, going over the edge. And there, you know, there certainly are secular forces which can be supported. I'm not sure how progressive they are. But there certainly is, a very strong secular middle ground in Pakistan. Certainly the ruling party there, Benazir Bhutto's People's Party, it's kind of corrupt and authoritarian, but it is secular. I'm certainly not waving any pom-poms for them by any stretch of the imagination. But the situation in the tribal borderlands, along the border with Afghanistan, is pretty grim. And the government, it's been very controversial, but the government has been, the Pakistani government has been cutting a sort of a peace for Sharia deal with these sort of Taliban militias which have taken up arms in the borderlands. And they've been saying, okay, you can have your own self-governing zones where you can impose Sharia law if you lay down arms and agree to a peace deal. And some of the militias have taken the bait, and there's been this big controversy, as listeners will be aware, who've been paying attention, where a video has come to light of a 17-year-old girl being brutally flogged by Taliban militants because, it's uncertain why. Some said that she had had an adulterous affair. According to other accounts, she had been engaged to a Taliban militant and broke off the engagement. In any event, this video has come to light, and the secular elements in Pakistan are up in arms that this is what the this peace for Sharia deal with the militias is going to lead to, and it's a fundamental betrayal of women's rights, for starters. So I'm not too crazy about this peace for Sharia stuff. On the other hand, above the protests of the Pakistani government, the Obama administration has not only continued to launch drone strikes on militant targets in the Pakistani borderlands, but has actually expanded the strikes. And they're up to they're happening like every couple of days, like a few times a week now. The U.S. is launching drone missile strikes on Pakistan. And neither of these strike me as acceptable. Okay? And unfortunately, it's sort of being posed to us as if there isn't any third alternative. You either support capitulating to the Taliban militias and giving them their own self-governing Sharia zones where women are going to be flogged, or you send in the drones and, wipe out missiles and wipe out villages with missile attacks. And it should be said, by the way, that now this has not been corroborated by the United Nations, refugee agency, but according to the Pakistani government, not necessarily the most objective source, but according to the Pakistani government, there has now been, hundreds of thousands of internally displaced persons who have been forced to flee the tribal borderlands by these missile strikes. Now, I don't know if the number is really hundreds of thousands. Even the figure of a million has been broached. I don't know if the number is that high. It's possible the number is exaggerated because the Pakistani government does have its own access to grind. But one would imagine that there are large numbers of refugees who have been displaced because, once again, the strikes have been happening every few days now. There's death falling down from the skies quite regularly. Numbers of this nature, they can be exaggerated, but they can't be a refugee crisis of this magnitude can be exaggerated, but it can't be invented from whole cloth. So, neither of these strike me as acceptable. And in fact, they're once again sort of flip sides of the same coin. Because, for instance, in this horrific horrific terrorist attack, which one of these jihadi outfits in Pakistan carried out, last week? They took over a military academy in Lahore, which is quite ominous because Lahore is nowhere near their heartland in the tribal borderlands. It's in the Punjab, and which is sort of the mainstream heartland, sort of most middle class part of Pakistan. And Lahore in particular is, sort of the city of the most cosmopolitan, open-minded city in Pakistan. They took over a military academy in Lahore and shot it up and killed a bunch of people in what had been a very, very well-executed operation. And they later issued a communique saying that it was in retaliation for the U.S. drone strikes on their territory. So the U.S. drone strikes on their territory legitimize these Taliban types and allow them to paint themselves as the resistance to foreign intervention. And similarly, the U.S. airstrikes and military presence in Afghanistan allows the Taliban in Afghanistan to do exactly the same thing, and the ongoing U.S. military presence in Iraq is allowing the Sunni insurgents there, who basically share the same sort of ideology, to do exactly the same thing. So I don't see that there's any contradiction whatsoever in opposing U.S. intervention and opposing the jihadis. In fact, I see them as fundamentally unified propositions. Well, there you go. I ranted on for almost a full hour. I didn't even get to all the points I wanted to get to. Nobody's calling. Because, as usual, when I talk about this stuff, people are just sort of befuddled. I don't know. Maybe some people will call in. You know what we're going to do? We're going to play more music. We're going to play a little bit more from the El Gusto Orchestra of Algiers. And I'm going to go to the Left Forum website and give you the exact specs for the panel on which I'm going to be speaking on Sunday. And then we'll take your phone calls for the remaining, it should be around 15 minutes, at 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900. All right, here's a little bit more of the El Gusto Orchestra of Algiers. Whoops. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. No. What's going on? Here. Well, I want to play cut 6. There we go. Thank you.
مال جفني يبكي بالدمع ليل ونهار مال جفني حبيبي صاحن الدم مال قلبي تلهب من نوم شاب النار مال قلب حبيبي ما هزت وقلوب مال عقلي يا ربي من جوار حيطان مال عقل حبيبي ما قاست وجوب مال سمعي طايح لهواها الحضار مال سمع حبيبي لهوي ما يطول مال جسمي نحل حتى صفار وكبار مال جسم حبيبي بازت وقلوب مال من قسم قلبي بالسيوف الشفار حز عقلي ورماداتي بالارجوع مال جفني يبكي بالدمع ليل ونهار مال جفن حبيبي صاحي من الدموع مال جفني يبكي بالدمع ليل ونهار مال جفن حبيبي صاحي من الدموع عم الوراقي شفتك من اللي عطل فراقك ما قلت يا ريح مدقت ما قلت يا ريح مدقت بعد غناك ما البحورين شفت من شدت الحراق ما البحورين شفت من شدت الحراق ما الرياحي سكنت من الزوا ما النجوم غربت من بعد العشرة ما المطار يفتت من السماء ما المطار يفتت من مزال السماء بسبب اللي فني بسبب اللي فنيت من حسن باقا بسبب اللي فني بسبب اللي فني مقول حسن باقا ملت خمامي في عشق النحس مطول مال سهر عيوني عنشوفهم
Okay, I found the information I'm looking for, and the board is lit up, so that's it for the Augusto Orchestra of Algiers for the moment. Hate to cut them short, but we'll hear some more of them on the way out. Okay, the name of the forum is going to be Building Solidarity with Iraq's Civil Resistance. The name of the panel, At the Left Forum, which is going to be happening at Pace University Sunday at 10 a.m. The previous day, I'm not quite sure what time, but the previous day, Saturday, there's going to be a forum about Afghanistan called by the Socialist Party, which I'm also going to attend and perhaps kibitz a little bit. And then actually later on Sunday, at 2 in the afternoon on Sunday, I'm going to be speaking on another panel about U.S. complicity with torture in Latin America. So you can check all this out online at leftforum.org. And I imagine all of you will, you know, cheer on what I have to say about U.S. complicity with torture in Latin America, but some of you are going to want to throw tomatoes at me for what I have to say about Iraq. So I'll give you the opportunity right now to throw some preemptive tomatoes. WBAI, you're on the air. Turn down your radio and speak up.
Yeah, Bill, it's Bob.
Okay.
Okay, RAWA.
Yeah.
All right, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan.
Oh, that Bob. Hi, Bob. Turn down your radio, Bob.
My radio's turned down.
Oh, okay, Bob.
Damn crab, shut up.
I'm getting this weird echo effect, but go on.
All right, look, I'm trying to punch it up.
All right, but,
hell.
Yes, RAWA, Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan.
Okay, yeah. Right, okay, here we go. Edit, RAWA, one, edit, punch. See what happens, nothing.
What are you talking about?
God damn it, I'm trying to get, God damn it.
God damn what? What are you
No, hold on. I'm trying to get their address, phone number, where to send money. You know,
all right, Bob, there's a simple solution. I hate to cut you short, but we've got some interference on the line here. And I link to RAWA on my website. So just go to www4report.com. That's an Arabic numeral 4, report.com, www4report.com. And scroll down, and you'll see the logo of RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. And you'll have the contact information and everything else that you need to send them money. And they really need money now because they're sort of losing their base of operations as the refugees are being forcibly repatriated from Pakistan.
Okay. I can't punch it up right now because...
Right. I just gave all the information, Bob.
Yeah. But you didn't give anything. Just go to your site is what you gave.
Yes, exactly.
I was going to give the exact address and everything.
Well...
My computer's going bonkers. Look, okay.
Well, that's because you're in Yonkers, man. Your computer's going bonkers in Yonkers. Bob, we're going to move on, but thanks for calling.
Don't move on. People should do something concrete about exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to do that.
What they should do is give... basically, all you can do is give them some money, give them some publicity, and if you've got time, if you've got the guts enough... Go out there and go underground with them and do something. You know, ha ha ha. You know, maybe one or two of us can do that.
They aren't asking for that kind of solidarity, Bob. I mean, we have to give them the kind of solidarity that they're asking for. Now, I would certainly like to go to Iraq as a journalist and give them some, give their movement some coverage. But nobody's ever funded me to do that, which I'm.
Okay,
not too happy
neither,
about.
We're neither east nor west, okay? All right, I'm just trying to get some concrete information and the freaking computer will...
Right, Bob, we don't have time to wait for you to get it on your computer. We got a lot of other calls, so call back if you get the information, or I'll try to get it, okay? WBAI, you're on the air. No, you're not. WBAI, you're on the air. Turn down your radio and speak up. No, leave me alone. WBAI, turn down your radio and speak up.
All right, I'm here, Bill. First little comment about that last caller. If he's so passionate and ready to support that that organization, which I, fully agree should be supported, you'd think he'd be prepared before he got on the radio and start, making all these remarks.
Is this the most important thing you have to say?
No, but I'm just saying, it just sort of like, bring question to his cause if he's not even prepared.
If this is what you called to say, I'm going to move on to another call.
No, okay, I'll tell you what I called to say.
Well, gee, thank you.
All right. Well, I missed a part of your lecture there. It was very interesting what I heard. So you might have addressed this before. But about the Somali pirates, what really is their issue? Am I to believe they're just a bunch of, criminals, Or is there more to the story than that?
That's a very good question. Okay, there has been some intimation that some of the pirate leaders have made statements to the media that, no, we aren't pirates, and we're actually doing this to get reparations for toxic waste dumping off of the coast of Somalia by European firms. Now, I don't doubt that in the atmosphere of chaos in Somalia over the past 20 years, that a bunch of, European toxic waste brokers have decided that they're going to, just dump toxic waste off the coast of Somalia. So this strikes me as a legitimate grievance. But if you're going to be, demanding reparations, I would like to see that some of the money is being democratically distributed to the people of Somalia and to the fishermen and so on who have had their livelihoods impacted by the toxic waste dumping. Or I would like to see that some of the money is being put into ecological remediation. And I haven't seen any evidence of that whatsoever. So there may be a legitimate grievance there, but I'm not convinced that the pirates are doing any more than exploiting it. I'm not closed to the possibility that they're actually doing something responsible with the money, but I haven't seen any evidence of it either.
I got you. All right, thanks for the info, Bill.
Thank you. On the subject of info, in a fraction of the time that the last caller spent complaining about the caller before that, and in a really, really minute fraction of the time that Bob spent wasting our time puttering around on the internet to get the address for RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, I just did exactly what I suggested the readers do. Go to www4report.com, click on the link for the Revolutionary Association of Women of Afghanistan, and you would find that you can send monetary donations to the Afghan Women's Mission, P.O.B. 40846, Pasadena, California, 91114. Once again, that's the Afghan Women's Mission, P.O.B. 40846, Pasadena, California, 91114. Make your check or money order payable to IHC/Afghan Women's Mission. Your tax-deductible contribution will be sent to RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. And you can find them directly. This is what I should have said to begin with. I wasn't sure of the address, but now I am because I'm looking at their page. And indeed it is, just as you might expect, rawa.org. That's rawa.org. Okay? Okay. Let's move on, shall we? WBAI, you're on the air.
Yeah, listen, Bill. The VL Gusto means that it's probably a male group. That L is like you wouldn't use that if it was a female.
Oh, God. Yeah. L goes before Gusto because it's a masculine noun. But the point is that V and L mean the same thing, so it's redundant.
But it sounds good. It's creative. You know, listen, give them a break. However, I will need translation. Now, the next thing
I'm sorry I don't speak Arabic, I mean, if you pay for my for some Arabic instruction, I'll take some Arabic instruction. Okay? You can use PayPal. Make a donation to my website. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
No. WBAI, you're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air.
And break down, what is this principle that you are precariously standing on?
Excuse me?
You keep mentioning that there's a violation of a principle that you object to. What is this principle?
I'm not quite sure exactly what you're referring to.
Well, you're not a moral philosopher. How can you mention even the word principle?
A moral philosopher? I don't even know what
you're
that means.
You're not a moral philosopher.
A moral philosopher.
And you're not even a phenomenologist, sir. So how can you mention
I'm not
principle?
Even an epidemiologist. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello. Speak up.
Yes,
I can hardly hear you.
Mr. Weinberg?
Yes.
Would like to ask you if you would ever have one of your prepared presentations on tape on air, and also about Iraq or any other subject of interest. And also, do you remember Murray Bookchin? I met him years ago.
I'll never forget Mary Bookchin, and all of the shows are archived on the internet. Go to our homepage, morc.info, click where it says The Radio Show, and follow the links. And it's all archived on the internet. You can listen to your heart's content. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello? WBAI, you're on the air. Hello, you're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air. Turn down your radio and speak up.
Okay, now, thank you for giving the American address of Rawa. Now stop laughing. Just let me give this, okay?
Yes.
For the people of the radio who don't want to go to their goddamn computer and stuff, it's finally on screen. Just Rawa. Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. R-A-W-A. Mailing address. Rawa. P-O-B. 374 Queta, Q-U-E-T-T-A, Pakistan. They have to be in Pakistan. If they're in Afghanistan, they'd have their throats slit. They do get into Afghanistan often to do things. I'm not going to talk about it right now, but they have to have their base outside of Afghanistan. All right, their mobile phone is 00092.
We don't want Monroe calling Rawa. I suggest that you don't give that. And furthermore, Bob, thank you. If people want to send Rawa fan mail or write them a note saying that you support what you're doing, then indeed you can write them at the POB 374 Quetta, Pakistan. But if you want to send a check, then once again, you send it to the Afghan Women's Mission, POB 40846, Pasadena, California, 91114, payable to IHC/Afghan Women's Mission. And we're going to refrain from giving the phone number for reasons which I believe are all too obvious. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello.
Hey, Bill. How you doing?
Okay.
It's a very good show. I just think you and Monroe need to get a life, man.
I've got a life. I thought you said it was a good show. If I didn't have a life, it wouldn't be a good show. WBAI, you're on the air. You're on the air.
Knucklehead!
Is that all you ever have to say? WBAI, you're on the air. Turn down the radio and speak up.
Yes, I'd like to know your opinion on the United States involvement in 9/11.
You know, what's really frustrating is that even when we do get some good calls on occasion, and we do on occasion get some good calls, it's all the nuts who come out at in the last, you know, minute or two of the show, and we always have to, like, go out on an ugly or stupid note. It's very frustrating. Let's see if anybody else out there is a little bit more intelligent. WBAI, you're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air. Make my night. Say something intelligent. WBAI, you're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air. I want somebody to say something intelligent in the minute or two remaining to us. BAI, you're on the air.
Bill?
Yes.
Hey, I had a cursory look at the article that was written by the man that Amy interviewed today, and there was an interesting thing on the fishing wars that have been taking place in the last, 10 years between not only EU fishing boats, but fishing boats from Turkey and Asia. I don't know if you...
Where, off the coast of Somalia?
Yeah.
Oh?
Yeah. Yeah, whoever Amy had on her show, it's worthwhile looking. She cited the article that he wrote.
Where did the article appear?
It's on the internet.
Thanks. Where on the internet?
If you look on Democracy Now! Today.
All right.
You know what I mean?
Okay.
It's worthwhile looking at. Anyway, it's just another side to the pretty complicated situation that's occurred there in the last 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, but thanks a lot for your other sort of bits of information. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Man. Bye.
Okay, well, should I go out on a good note or should I risk another call? You know what? We're going to go out on a good note because we want to hear a little bit more from the El Gusto Orchestra of Algiers. Stay tuned for Weaponry, coming up next with Tom Whisker. And join us next week on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. See you at the Left Forum tomorrow. Anybody who didn't get, I mean Sunday, anybody who didn't get on the air tonight, all of you people who are trying to call in, I'm not taking any more phone calls because the show is over. You want to argue with me? Argue with me at 10 o'clock in the morning on Sunday at Pace University. I'd love to see you. So show up and give me some grief. I'm a glutton for punishment. I love it. See ya. Salam alaikum.
مال وجدي حصل وسط الدمير لازال مال سلواني من نار الفراق زايل
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.